that he fancied spending alone. Chapter 42. Matteo. An odd toy. Giuliano. I. To mock an ape withal. Ben Jonson. Every man in his humour. Robin arrived at work on Monday morning, feeling tired and vaguely battle-weary, but proud of herself. She and Matthew had spent most of the weekend discussing her job. In some ways, strange to think this after 9 years together, it had been the deepest and most serious conversation that they had ever had. Why had she not admitted for so long that her secret interest in investigative work had long predated meeting Cormoran Strike? Matthew had seemed stunned when she had finally confessed to him that she had had an ambition to work in some form of criminal investigation since her early teens.
"I'd have thought it would have been the last thing," Matthew had mumbled, tailing off but referring obliquely, as Robin knew, to the reason she had dropped out of university.
"I just never knew how to say it to you," she told him. "I thought you'd laugh. So it wasn't Cormoran making me stay, or anything to do with him as a person."
She had been on the verge of saying, "as a man," but saved herself just in time.
"It was me. It's what I want to do. I love it. And now he says he'll train me, Matt, and that's what I always wanted."
The discussion had gone on all through Sunday, the disconcerted Matthew shifting slowly, like a boulder.
"How much weekend work?" he had asked her suspiciously.
"I don't know. When it's needed, Matt, I love the job, don't you understand? I don't want to pretend any more. I just want to do it, and I'd like your support."
In the end, he had put his arms around her and agreed. She had tried not to feel grateful that his mother had just died, making him, she could not help thinking, just a little more amenable to persuasion than he might usually have been. Robin had been looking forward to telling Strike about this mature development in her relationship, but he was not in the office when she arrived. Lying on the desk beside her tiny tinsel tree was a short note in his distinctive, hard-to-read handwriting. "No milk, gone out for breakfast, then to Hamley's, want to beat crowds. P.S. Know who killed Quine." Robin gasped. Seizing the phone, she called Strike's mobile, only to hear the engage signal. Hamley's would not open until 10, but Robin did not think she could bear to wait that long. Again and again she pressed redial while she opened and sorted the post, but Strike was still on the other call. She opened emails, the phone clamped to one ear. Half an hour passed, then an hour, and still the engaged tone emanated from Strike's number. She began to feel irritated, suspecting that it was a deliberate ploy to keep her in suspense. At 10:30, a soft ping from the computer announced the arrival of an email from an unfamiliar sender called Claudia2@live.com, who had sent nothing but an attachment labelled FYI. Robin clicked on it automatically, still listening to the engage tone. A large black-and-white picture swelled to fill her computer monitor. The backdrop was stark, an overcast sky and the exterior of an old stone building. Everyone in the picture was out of focus except the bride, who had turned to look directly at the camera. She was wearing a long, plain, slim-fitting white gown with a floor-length veil held in place by a thin diamond band. Her black hair was flying like the folds of tulle in what looked like a stiff breeze. One hand was clasped in that of a blurred figure in a morning suit who appeared to be laughing. But her expression was unlike any bride's that Robin had ever seen. She looked broken, bereft, haunted. Her eyes staring straight into Robin's, as though they alone were friends. As though Robin were the only one who might understand. Robin lowered the mobile she had been listening to, and stared at the picture. She had seen that extraordinarily beautiful face before. They had spoken once, on the telephone. Robin remembered a low, attractively husky voice. This was Charlotte, Strike's ex-fiancée, the woman she had once seen running from this very building. She was so beautiful. Robin felt strangely humbled by the other woman's looks, and awed by her profound sadness. 16 years, on and off with Strike. Strike, with his pube-like hair, his boxer's profile, and his half a leg. Not that those things mattered, Robin told herself, staring transfixed at this incomparably stunning, sad bride. The door opened. Strike was suddenly there beside her, two carrier bags of toys in his hands, and Robin, who had not heard him coming up the stairs, jumped as though she had been caught pilfering from the petty cash. "Morning," he said. She reached hastily for the computer mouse, trying to close down the picture before he could see it, but her scramble to cover up what she was viewing drew his eyes irresistibly to the screen. Robin froze, shamefaced. "She sent it a few minutes ago. I didn't know what it was when I opened it. Sorry. Strike stared at the picture for a few seconds, then turned away, setting the bags of toys down on the floor by her desk.
"Just delete it," he said.
He sounded neither sad nor angry, but firm. Robin hesitated, then closed the file, deleted the email, and emptied the trash folder.
"Cheers," he said, straightening up,
and by his manner informed her that there would be no discussion of Charlotte's wedding picture.
"I've got about 30 missed calls from you on my phone."
"Well, what do you expect?" said Robin with spirit. "Your note, you said..."
"I had to take a call from my aunt," said Strike. "An hour and 10 minutes on the medical complaints of everyone in St. Maur's, all because I told her I'm going home for Christmas."
He laughed at the sight of her barely contained frustration.
"All right, but we gotta be quick. I've just realized there's something we could do this morning before I meet Fancourt."
Still wearing his coat, he sat down on the leather sofa and talked for 10 solid minutes, laying his theory before her in detail. When he had finished, there was a long silence. The misty, mystical image of the boy angel in her local church floated into Robin's mind as she stared at Strike in near total disbelief.
"Which bits cause a new problems?" asked Strike kindly.
Said Robin.
"We already agreed that Quine's disappearance might not have been spontaneous, right?" Strike asked her. "If you add together the mattress at Talgarth Road, convenient in a house that hasn't been used in 25 years, and the fact that a week before he vanished Quine told that bloke in the bookshop he was going away and bought himself reading material, and the waitress in the River Cafe saying Quine wasn't really angry when he was shouting at Tassel, that he was enjoying himself, I think we can hypothesize a staged disappearance." "Okay," she said.
This part of Strike's theory seemed the least outlandish to her. She did not know where to begin in telling him how implausible she found the rest of it, but the urge to pick holes made her say, "Wouldn't he have told Leonora what he was planning, though?"
"Course not. She can't act to save her life. He wanted her worried, so she'd be convincing when she went round telling everybody he'd disappeared. Maybe she'd even involve the police, make a fuss with the publisher, start the panic."
"But that had never worked," said Robin. "He was always flouncing off and nobody cared. Surely even he must have realized that he wasn't going to get massive publicity just for running away and hiding in his old house."
"Ah. But this time he was leaving behind him a book he thought was going to be the talk of literary London, wasn't he? He'd drawn as much attention to it as he could by rowing with his agent in the middle of a packed restaurant and making a public threat to self-publish. He goes home, stages the grand walk out in front of Leonora, and slips off to Talgarth Road. Later that evening he lets in his accomplice without a second thought, convinced that they're in it together.
After a long pause, Robin said bravely, because she was not used to challenging Strike's conclusions, which she had never known to be wrong, "But you haven't got a single piece of evidence that there was an accomplice, let alone, I mean, it's all opinion." He began to reiterate points he had already made, but she held up her hand to stop him. "I heard all that the first time, but you're extrapolating from things people have said. There's no physical evidence at all."
"Of course there is," said Strike. "Bombyx Mori. That's not, it's the single biggest piece of evidence we've got.
You're the one," said Robin, "who's always telling me means an opportunity. You're the one who's always saying motive doesn't..."
"I haven't said a word about motive," Strike reminded her. "As it happens, I'm not sure what the motive was, although I've got a few ideas. And if you want more physical evidence, you can come and help me get it right now."
She looked at him suspiciously. In all the time she had worked for him, he had never asked her to collect a physical clue.
"I want you to come and help me talk to Orlando Quine," he said, pushing himself back off the sofa. "I don't want to do it on my own. She's tricky. Doesn't like my hair. She's in Ladbroke Grove with a next-door neighbour, so we better get a move on."
"This is the daughter with learning difficulties?" Robin asked, puzzled.
"Yeah," said Strike. "She's got this monkey plush thing hangs around her neck. I've just seen a pile of them in Hamleys. They're really pajama cases. Cheeky monkeys, they call them."
Robin was staring at him as though fearful for his sanity.
"When I met her, she had it round her neck, and she kept producing things out of nowhere. Pictures, crayons, and a card she sneaked off the kitchen table. I've just realized she was pulling it all out of the pajama case. She nicks things from people," Strike went on, "and she was in and out of her father's study all the time when he was alive. He used to give her paper to draw on."
"You're hoping she's carrying around a clue to her father's killer inside her pajama case?"
"No. But I think there's reasonable chance that she picked up a bit of Bombyx Mori while she was skulking around in Quine's office, or that he gave her the back of an early draft to draw on. I'm looking for scraps of paper with notes on them. A discarded couple of paragraphs, anything. Look, I know it's a long shot," said Strike, correctly reading her expression. "But we can't get into Quine's study. The police have already been through everything in there and come up with nothing, and I'm betting the notebooks and drafts Quine took away with him have been destroyed. Cheeky Monkey's the last place I can think of to look, and..." He checked his watch. "We haven't got much time if we're going to Ladbroke Grove and back before I meet Fancourt. Which reminds me..."
He left the office. Robin heard him heading upstairs, and thought he must be going to his flat. But then the sounds of rummaging told her that he was searching the boxes of his possessions on the landing. When he returned, he was holding a box of latex gloves that he had clearly filched before leaving the SIB for good, and a clear plastic evidence bag of exactly the size that airlines provided to hold toiletries.
"There's another crucial bit of physical evidence I'd like to get," he said, taking out a pair of gloves and handing them to an uncomprehending Robin. "I thought you could have a bash at getting hold of it while I'm with Fancourt this afternoon."
In a few succinct words, he explained what he wanted her to get and why. Not altogether to Strike's surprise, a stunned silence followed his instructions.
"You're joking," said Robin faintly. "I'm not."
She raised one hand unconsciously to her mouth.
"It won't be dangerous," Strike reassured her.
"That's not what's worrying me. Cormoran, that's horrific. Are you really serious?"
"If you'd seen Leonora Quine in Holloway last week, you wouldn't ask that," said Strike darkly. "We're going to have to be bloody clever to get her out of there."
"Clever," thought Robin, still phased as she stood with the limp gloves dangling from her hand. His suggestions for the day's activities seemed wild, bizarre,
and in the case of the last, disgusting.
"Look," he said, suddenly serious. "I don't know what to tell you except I can feel it. I can smell it, Robin. Someone deranged, bloody dangerous but efficient, lurking behind all this. They got that idiot Quine exactly where they wanted him by playing on his narcissism. And I'm not the only one who thinks so either."
Strike threw Robin her coat, and she put it on. He was tucking evidence bags into his inside pocket.
"People kept telling me there was someone else involved. Chard says it was Waldegrave, Waldegrave says it's Tassel. Pippa Midgley's too stupid to interpret what's staring her in the face, and Christian Fisher... well, he's got more perspective not being in the book," said Strike. "He put his finger on it without realizing it."
Robin, who was struggling to keep up with Strike's thought processes, and skeptical of those parts she could understand, followed him down the metal staircase and out into the cold.
"This murder," said Strike,
lighting a cigarette as they walked down Denmark Street together,
"was months, if not years, in the planning. Work a genius when you think about it, but it's over-elaborate and that's going to be its downfall. You can't plot a murder like a novel. There are always loose ends in real life."
Strike could tell that he was not convincing Robin, but he was not worried. He had worked with disbelieving subordinates before. Together, they descended into the tube and onto a central line train.
"What did you get for your nephews?" Robin asked after a long silence.
"Camouflage gear and fake guns," said Strike,
whose choice had been entirely motivated by the desire to aggravate his brother-in-law.
"And I got Timothy Anstis a bloody big drum. They'll enjoy that at 5 o'clock on Christmas morning."
In spite of her preoccupation, Robin snorted with laughter. The quiet row of houses from which Owen Quine had fled a month previously was, like the rest of London, covered in snow, pristine and pale on the roofs, and grubby grey underfoot. The happy Inuit smiled down from his pub sign, like the presiding deity of the wintry street, as they passed beneath him. A different policeman stood outside the Quine residence now, and a white van was parked at the curb with its doors open.
"Digging for guts in the garden," Strike muttered to Robin,
as they drew nearer and spotted spades lying on the floor.
"They didn't have any luck at Mucking Marshes, and they're not going to have any luck in Leonora's flower beds either."
"So you say," replied Robin, sotto voce, a little intimidated by the staring policeman, who was quite handsome.
"So you're going to help me prove this afternoon," replied Strike under his breath.
"Morning,"
he called to the watchful constable, who did not respond. Strike seemed energized by his crazy theory, but if by any remote chance he was right, Robin thought, the killing had grotesque features even beyond that carved-out corpse. They headed up the front path of the house beside the Quines, bringing them within feet of the watchful PC. Strike rang the bell, and after a short wait, the door opened, revealing a short, anxious-looking woman in her early 60s, who was wearing a housecoat and wool-trimmed slippers.
"Are you Edna?" Strike asked.
"Yes," she said timidly, looking up at him.
When Strike introduced himself and Robin, Edna's furrowed brow relaxed, to be replaced by a look of pathetic relief.
"Oh, it's you. I've heard all about you. You're helping Leonora. You're going to get her out, aren't you?"
Robin felt horribly aware of the handsome PC listening to all of it, feet away.
"Come in, come in," said Edna,
backing out of their way and beckoning them enthusiastically inside.
"Mrs., I'm sorry I don't know your surname," began Strike,
wiping his feet on the doormat. Our house was warm, clean, and much cosier than the Quines, though identical in layout.
"Call me Edna," she said, beaming at him.
"Edna, thank you. You know, you ought to ask to see ID before you let anyone into your house."
Oh, but, said Edna, flustered, Leonora told me all about you.
Strike insisted, nevertheless, on showing her his driving license before following her down the hall into a blue and white kitchen much brighter than Leonora's.
She's upstairs, said Edna,
when Strike explained that they had come to see Orlando.
She's not having a good day. Do you want coffee?
As she flitted around fetching cups, she talked non-stop in the pent-up fashion of the stressed and lonely.
Don't get me wrong, I don't mind having a poor lamb, but...
She looked hopelessly between Strike and Robin, then blurted out,
But how long for? They've no family, you see. There was a social worker around yesterday checking on her. She said if I couldn't keep her, she'd have to go in a home or something. I said, you can't do that to Orlando. They've never been apart, her and her mum. No. She can stay with me, but...
Edna glanced at the ceiling.
She's very unsettled just now, very upset. Just wants her mum to come home, and what can I say to her? I can't tell her the truth, can I? And there they are, next door, digging up the whole garden. They've gone and dug up Mr. Poop.
Dead cat, Strike muttered under his breath to Robin, as tears bubbled behind Edna's spectacles and bounced down her round cheeks.
Poor lamb, she said again.
When she had given Strike and Robin their coffees, Edna went upstairs to fetch Orlando. It took 10 minutes for her to persuade the girl to come downstairs, but Strike was glad to see Cheeky Monkey clutched in her arms when she appeared, today dressed in a grubby tracksuit and wearing a sullen expression.
He's called like a giant,
she announced to the kitchen at large when she saw Strike.
I am, said Strike, nodding. Well remembered.
Orlando slid into the chair that Edna pulled out for her, holding her orangutan tightly in her arms.
I'm Robin, said Robin, smiling at her. Like a bird, said Orlando at once. Dodo's a bird. It's what her mum and dad called her, explained Edna. We're both birds, said Robin.
Orlando gazed at her, then got up and walked out of the kitchen without speaking. Edna sighed deeply.
She takes upset over everything. You never know what she's...
But Orlando had returned with crayons and a spiral-bound drawing pad that Strike was sure had been bought by Edna to try to keep her happy. Orlando sat down at the kitchen table and smiled at Robin, a sweet, open smile that made Robin feel unaccountably sad.
I'm going to draw you a Robin, she announced.
I'd love that, said Robin.
Orlando set to work with her tongue between her teeth. Robin said nothing, but watched the picture develop. Feeling that Robin had already forged a better rapport with Orlando than he had managed, Strike ate a chocolate biscuit offered by Edna and made small talk about the snow. Eventually, Orlando finished her picture, tore it out of the pad, and pushed it across to Robin.
It's beautiful, said Robin, beaming at her. I wish I could draw a dodo, but I can't draw at all.
This, Strike knew, was a lie. Robin drew very well. He had seen her doodles.
I've got to give you something, though.
She rummaged in her bag, watched eagerly by Orlando, and eventually pulled out a small round makeup mirror decorated on the back with a stylized pink bird.
There, said Robin. Look, that's a flamingo, another bird. You can keep that.
Orlando took her gift with parted lips, staring at it.
Say thank you to the lady, prompted Edna.
Thank you, said Orlando,
and she slid the mirror inside the pajama case.
Is he a bag?
Asked Robin, with bright interest.
My monkey,
said Orlando, clutching the orangutan closer.
My daddy gave him to me. My daddy died.
I'm sorry to hear that,
said Robin quietly, wishing that the image of Quine's body had not slid instantly into her mind, his torso as hollow as a pajama case. Strike surreptitiously checked his watch. The appointment with Fancourt was drawing ever closer. Robin sipped some coffee and asked,
"Do you keep things in your monkey?"
"I like your hair," said Orlando.
"It's shiny and yellow."
"Thank you," said Robin.
"Have you got any other pictures in there?"
Orlando nodded.
"Can I have a biscuit?"
she asked Edna.
"Can I see your other pictures?"
Robin asked as Orlando munched.
And after a brief pause for consideration, Orlando opened up her orangutan.
A sheaf of crumpled pictures came out, on an assortment of different sized and coloured papers. Neither Strike nor Robin turned them over at first, but made admiring comments as Orlando spread them out across the table, Robin asking questions about the bright starfish and the dancing angels that Orlando had drawn in crayon and felt tip. Basking in their appreciation, Orlando dug deeper into her pajama case for her working materials. Up came a used typewriter cartridge, oblong and grey, with a thin strip tape carrying the reversed words it had printed. Strike resisted the urge to palm it immediately as it disappeared beneath a tin of coloured pencils and a box of mints, but kept his eye on it as Orlando laid out a picture of a butterfly, through which could be seen traces of untidy adult writing on the back. Encouraged by Robin, Orlando now brought out more. A sheet of stickers, a postcard of the Mendip Hills, a round fridge magnet that read, "Careful, you may end up in my novel." Last of all, she showed them three images on better quality paper, two proofbook illustrations, and a mocked-up book cover.
"My daddy gave me them from his work," Orlando said. "Daniel Chow touched me when I wanted it," she said, pointing at a brightly coloured picture that Strike recognised. Kyla the kangaroo, who loved to bounce. Orlando had added a hat and handbag to Kyla, and coloured in the line drawing of a princess talking to a frog with neon felt tips. Delighted to see Orlando so chatty, Edna made more coffee. Conscious of the time, but aware of the need not to provoke a row and a protective grab of all her treasures, Robin and Strike chatted as they picked up and examined each of the pieces of paper on the table. Whenever she thought something might be helpful, Robin slid it sideways to Strike. There was a list of scribbled names on the back of the butterfly picture. Sam Breville, Eddie Boyne, Edward Baskinville, Stephen Brooke. The postcard of the Mendip Hills had been sent in July and carried a brief message. "Weather great, hotel disappointing, hope the book's going well, V, kiss kiss." Other than that, there was no trace of handwriting. A few of Orlando's pictures were familiar to Strike from his last visit. One had been drawn on the reverse of a child's restaurant menu, another on the Quine's gas bill.
"Well, we better head off," said Strike, draining his coffee cup with a decent show of regret.
Almost absent-mindedly, he continued to hold the cover image for Dorcas Pengelly's Upon the Wicked Rocks. A bedraggled woman lay supine on the stony sands of a steep cliff-enclosed cove, with the shadow of a man falling across her midriff. Orlando had drawn thickly lined black fish in the seething blue water. The used typewriter cassette lay beneath the image, nudged there by Strike.
"I don't want you to go,"
Orlando told Robin, suddenly tense and tearful.
"It's been lovely, hasn't it?" said Robin.
"I'm sure we'll see each other again. You'll keep your flamingo mirror, won't you? And I've got my Robin picture."
But Orlando had begun to wail and stamp. She did not want another goodbye. Under cover of the escalating furore, Strike wrapped the typewriter cassette smoothly in the cover illustration for Upon the Wicked Rocks and slid it into his pocket, unmarked by his fingerprints. They reached the street 5 minutes later, Robin, a little shaken, because Orlando had wailed and tried to grab her as she headed down the hall. Edna had had to physically restrain Orlando from following them.
"Poor girl,"
said Robin under her breath, so that the staring PC could not hear them.
Oh, God, that was dreadful.
Useful, though, said Strike. You got that typewriter ribbon?
Yep,
said Strike, glancing over his shoulder to check that the PC was out of sight before taking out the cassette, still wrapped in Dorcas's cover, and tipping it into a plastic evidence bag. And a bit more than that.
You did,
said Robin, surprised.
Possible lead, said Strike. Might be nothing.
He glanced again at his watch and sped up, wincing as his knee throbbed in protest.
I'm going to have to get a move on if I'm not going to be late for Fancourt.
As they sat on the crowded tube train carrying them back to central London 20 minutes later, Strike said,
You're clear about what you're doing this afternoon?
Completely clear, said Robin, but with a note of reservation. I know it's not a fun job. That's not what's bothering me. And like I say, it shouldn't be dangerous, he said, preparing to stand as they approached Tottenham Court Road. But...
Something made him reconsider, a slight frown between his heavy eyebrows.
Your hair, he said.
What's wrong with it?
Said Robin, raising her hand self-consciously.
It's memorable, said Strike. Haven't got a hat, have you?
I could buy one, said Robin, feeling oddly flustered.
Charge it to petty cash, he told her. Can't hurt to be careful.
Chapter 43
Hoyday! What a sweep of vanity comes this way!
William Shakespeare, Timon of Athens. Strike walked up crowded Oxford Street, past snatches of canned carols and seasonal pop songs, and turned left into the quieter, narrower Dean Street. There were no shops here, just block-like buildings packed together with their different faces, white, red, and dun, opening into offices, bars, pubs, or bistro-type restaurants. Strike paused to allow boxes of wine to pass from delivery van to catering entrance. Christmas was a more subtle affair here in Soho, where the arts world, the advertisers and publishers congregated, and nowhere more so than at the Groucho Club. A grey building, almost nondescript, with its black-framed windows and small topiaries, sitting behind plain, convex balustrades. Its cachet lay not in its exterior, but in the fact that relatively few were allowed within the members-only club for the creative arts. Strike limped over the threshold, and found himself in a small hall area, where a girl behind a counter said pleasantly,
"Can I help you?"
"I am here to meet Michael Fancourt."
"Oh yes, you're Mr. Strick."
"That's me," said Strike.
He was directed through a long barroom with leather seats packed with lunchtime drinkers, and up the stairs. As he climbed, Strike reflected, not for the first time, that his special investigation branch training had not envisaged him conducting interviews without official sanction or authority, on a suspect's own territory, where his interviewee had the right to terminate the encounter without reason or apology. The SIB required its officers to organize their questioning in a template of people, places, things. Strike never lost sight of the effective, rigorous methodology, but these days it was essential to disguise the fact that he was filing facts in mental boxes. Different techniques were required when interviewing those who thought they were doing you a favor. He saw his quarry immediately he stepped into a second wooden-floored bar, where sofas in primary colours were set along the wall beneath paintings by modern artists. Fancourt was sitting slantwise on a bright red couch, one arm along its back, a leg a little raised in an exaggerated pose of ease. A Damien Hirst spot painting hung right behind his overlarge head, like a neon halo. The writer had a thick thatch of greying dark hair. His features were heavy, and the lines beside his generous mouth deep. He smiled as Strike approached. It was not perhaps the smile he would have given someone he considered an equal. Impossible not to think in those terms, given the studied affectation of ease, the habitually sour expression, but a gesture to one whom he wished to be gracious.
Mr. Strike.
Perhaps he considered standing up to shake hands, but Strike's height and bulk often dissuaded smaller men from leaving their seats. They shook hands across the small wooden table. Unwillingly, but left with no choice unless he wanted to sit on the sofa with Fancourt, a far too cozy situation, particularly with the author's arm lying along the back of it, Strike sat down on a solid round puff that was unsuited both to his size and his sore knee. Beside them was a shaven-headed ex-soap star who had recently played a soldier in a BBC drama. He was talking loudly about himself to two other men. Fancourt and Strike ordered drinks, but declined menus. Strike was relieved that Fancourt was not hungry. He could not afford to buy anyone else lunch.
"How long have you been a member of this place?" he asked Fancourt, when the waiter had left. "Since it opened. I was an early investor," said Fancourt. "Only club I've ever needed. I stay overnight here if I need to. There are rooms upstairs."
Fancourt fixed Strike with a consciously intense stare.
"I've been looking forward to meeting you. The hero of my next novel is a veteran of the so-called War on Terror and its military corollaries. I'd like to pick your brains once we've got Owen Quine out of the way."
Strike happened to know a little about the tools available to the famous when they wished to manipulate. Lucy's guitarist father, Rick, was less famous than either Strike's father or Fancourt, but still celebrated enough to cause a middle-aged woman to gasp and tremble at the sight of him queuing for ice creams in St. Moore's.
"Oh my God, what are you doing here?"
Rick had once confided in the adolescent Strike that the one sure way to get a woman into bed was to tell her you were writing a song about her. Michael Fancourt's pronouncement that he was interested in capturing something of Strike in his next novel felt like a variation on the same theme. He had clearly not appreciated that seeing himself in print was neither a novelty to Strike nor something he had ever chased. With an unenthusiastic nod to acknowledge Fancourt's request, Strike took out a notebook.
"Do you mind if I use this? Helps me remember what I want to ask you." "Feel free," said Fancourt, looking amused.
He tossed aside the copy of The Guardian that he had been reading. Strike saw the picture of a wizened but distinguished-looking old man who was vaguely familiar, even upside down. The caption read, "Pinkelman at 90.
"Dear old Pinks," said Fancourt, noticing the direction of Strike's gaze. "We're giving him a little party at the Chelsea Arts Club next week." "Yeah?" said Strike, hunting for a pen. "He knew my uncle. They did their national service together," said Fancourt. "When I wrote my first novel, Bellafront, I was fresh out of Oxford. My poor old unc, trying to be helpful, sent a copy to Pinkelman, who was the only writer he'd ever met."
He spoke in measured phrases, as though some invisible third party were taking down every word in shorthand. The story sounded pre-rehearsed, as though he had told it many times, and perhaps he had. He was an oft-interviewed man.
"Pinkelman, at that time author of the seminal Bunty's Big Adventure series, didn't understand a word I'd written," Fancourt went on. "But to please my uncle, he forwarded it to Charred Books, where it landed, most fortuitously, on the desk of the only person in the place who could understand it." "Stroke of luck," said Strike.
The waiter returned with wine for Fancourt and a glass of water for Strike.
"So," said the detective, "were you returning a favour when you introduced Pinkelman to your agent?" "I was," said Fancourt,
and his nod held the hint of patronage of a teacher glad to note that one of his pupils had been paying attention.
"In those days, Pinks was with some agent who kept forgetting
to hand on his royalties. Whatever you say about Elizabeth Tassel, she's honest. In business terms, she's honest, Fancourt amended, sipping his wine. She'll be at Pinkelman's party too, won't she? Said Strike, watching Fancourt for his reaction. She still represents him, doesn't she? It doesn't matter to me if Liz is there. Does she imagine that I'm still burning with malice towards her? Asked Fancourt, with his sour smile. I don't think I give Liz Tassel a thought from one year's end to the next. Why did she refuse to ditch Quine when you asked her to? Asked Strike. Strike did not see why he should not deploy the direct attack to a man who had announced an ulterior motive for meeting within seconds of their first encounter. It was never a question of me asking her to drop Quine, said Fancourt, still in measured cadences for the benefit of that invisible amanuensis. I explained that I could not remain at her agency while he was there, and left. I see, said Strike, who was well used to the splitting of hairs. Why do you think she let you leave? You were the bigger fish, weren't you? I think it's fair to say that I was a barracuda compared to Quine Stickleback, said Fancourt with a smirk. But you see, Liz and Quine were sleeping together. Really? I didn't know that, said Strike, clicking out the nib of his pen. Liz arrived at Oxford, said Fancourt. This strapping great girl who'd been helping her father castrate bulls and the like on sundry northern farms, desperate to get laid, and nobody fancied the job much. She had a thing for me, a very big thing. We were tutorial partners, juicy Jacobean intrigue calculated to get a girl going, but I never felt altruistic enough to relieve her of her virginity. We remained friends, said Fancourt, and when she started her agency I introduced her to Quine, who notoriously preferred to plumb the bottom of the barrel, sexually speaking. The inevitable occurred. Very interesting, said Strike. Is this common knowledge? I doubt it, said Fancourt. Quine was already married to his, well, his murderess. I suppose we have to call her now, don't we? He said thoughtfully. I'd imagine murderous Trump's wife when defining a close relationship. And Liz would have threatened him with dire consequences if he'd been his usual indiscreet self about her bedroom antics, on the wild off chance that I might yet be persuaded to sleep with her. Was this blind vanity, Strike wondered, a matter of fact, or a mixture of both? She used to look at me with those big cow eyes, waiting, hoping, said Fancourt, a cruel twist to his mouth. After Ellie died, she realized that I wasn't going to oblige her even when grief-stricken. I'd imagine she was unable to bear the thought of decades of future celibacy, so she stood by her man. Did you ever speak to Quine again after you left the agency? Strike asked. For the first few years after Ellie died, he'd scuttle out of any bar I entered, said Fancourt. Eventually, he got brave enough to remain in the same restaurant, throwing me nervous looks. No, I don't think we spoke to each other ever again, said Fancourt, as though the matter were of little interest. You were injured in Afghanistan, I think. Yeah, said Strike. It might work on women, Strike reflected, the calculated intensity of the gaze. Perhaps Owen Quine had fixed Catherine Kent and Pippa Midgley with the identical hungry vampiric stare when he told them he would be putting them into Bombix Mori. And they had been thrilled to think of part of themselves, their lives, forever encased in the amber of a writer's prose.
"How did it happen?"
asked Fancourt, his eyes on Strike's legs.
"IED," said Strike.
What about Talgarth Road? You and Quine were co-owners of the house. Didn't you ever need to communicate about the place? Did you ever run into each other there?
Never.
Haven't you been there to check on it? You've owned it, what, 20, 25 years, something like that, said Fancourt indifferently.
No, I haven't been inside since Joe died.
I suppose the police have asked you about the woman who thinks she saw you outside on the 8th of November.
Yes, said Fancourt shortly. She was mistaken.
Beside them, the actor was still in full and loud flow.
Thought I bloody had it. Couldn't see where the fuck I was supposed to be running. Sand in my bloody eyes.
So you haven't been in the house since 86?
No,
said Fancourt impatiently.
Neither Owen nor I wanted it in the first place.
Why not?
Because our friend Joe died there in exceptionally squalid circumstances. He hated hospitals, refused medication. By the time he fell unconscious, the place was in a disgusting state, and he, who had been the living embodiment of Apollo, was reduced to a sack of bones, his skin...
It was a grisly end, said Fancourt, made worse by Daniel Ch... Fancourt's expression hardened. He made an odd chewing motion as though literally eating unspoken words. Strike waited.
"He's an interesting man, Dan Chard," said Fancourt,
with a palpable effort at reversing out of the cul-de-sac into which he'd driven himself.
"I thought Owen's treatment of him in Bombyx Mori was the biggest missed opportunity of all, though future scholars are hardly going to look to Bombyx Mori for subtlety of characterization, are they?" he added with a short laugh.
"How would you have written Daniel Chard?" Strike asked. And Fancourt seemed surprised by the question. After a moment's consideration, he said,
"Dan's the most unfulfilled man I've ever met. He works in a field where he's competent but unhappy. He craves the bodies of young men, but can bring himself to do no more than draw them. He's full of inhibitions and self-disgust, which explains his unwise and hysterical response to Owen's caricature of him. Dan was dominated by a monstrous socialite mother who wanted her pathologically shy son to take over the family business. I think," said Fancourt, "I'd have been able to make something interesting of all that."
"Why did Chard turn down Northbrook?" Strike asked. Fancourt made the chewing motion again, then said,
"I like Daniel Chard, you know. I had the impression that there had been a grudge at some point," said Strike. "What gave you that idea?"
"You said that you certainly didn't expect to find yourself back at Roper Chard when you spoke at their anniversary party."
"You were there," said Fancourt sharply, and when Strike nodded he said, "Why?"
"I was looking for Quine," said Strike.
"His wife had hired me to find him. But as we know now, she knew exactly where he was."
"No," said Strike, "I don't think she did."
"You genuinely believe that?" asked Fancourt, his large head tilted to one side.
"Yeah, I do," said Strike. Fancourt raised his eyebrows, considering Strike intently as though he were a curiosity in a cabinet.
"So you didn't hold it against Chard that he turned down North's book?" Strike asked, returning to the main point.
After a brief pause, Fancourt said,
"Well, yes, I did hold it against him. Exactly why Dan changed his mind about publishing it, only Dan could tell you. But I think it was because there was a smattering of press around Joe's condition, drumming up Middle England disgust about the unrepentant book he was about to publish, and Dan, who had not realized that Joe now had full-blown AIDS, panicked. He didn't want it to be associated with bathhouses and AIDS, so he told Joe he didn't want the book after all. It was an act of great cowardice, and Owen and I...
Another pause. How long had it been since Fancourt had bracketed himself and Quine together in amity?
Owen and I believed that it killed Joe. He could hardly hold a pen. He was virtually blind. But he was trying desperately to finish the book before he died. We felt that was all that was keeping him alive. Then Chard's letter arrived, cancelling their contract. Joe stopped work, and within 48 hours he was dead.
There are similarities, said Strike, with what happened to your first wife.
They weren't the same thing at all, said Fancourt flatly.
Why not?
Joe's was an infinitely better book.
Yet another pause, this time much longer.
That's considering the matter, said Fancourt, from a purely literary perspective. Naturally, there are other ways of looking at it.
He finished his glass of wine and raised a hand to indicate to the barman that he wanted another. The actor beside them, who had barely drawn breath, was still talking.
Said, "Screw authenticity. What you want me to do? Saw me own bloody arm off?"
"It must have been a very difficult time for you," said Strike.
"Yes," said Fancourt waspishly. "Yes, I think we can call it difficult.
You lost a good friend and a wife within, what, months of each other?"
"A few months, yes." "You were writing all through that time?" "Yes," said Fancourt, with an angry, condescending laugh. "I was writing all through that time. It's my profession. Would anyone ask you whether you were still in the army while you were having private difficulties?"
"I doubt it," said Strike, without rancor.
"What were you writing?"
"It was never published. I abandoned the book I was working on so that I could finish Joe's."
The waiter set a second glass in front of Fancourt and departed.
"Did North's book need much doing to it?"
"Hardly anything," said Fancourt. "He was a brilliant writer. I tidied up a few rough bits and polished the ending. He'd left notes about how he wanted it done. Then I took it to Jerry Waldegrave, who was with Roper."
Strike remembered what Chard had said about Fancourt's over-closeness to Waldegrave's wife, and proceeded with some caution.
"Had you worked with Waldegrave before?"
"I've never worked with him on my own stuff, but I knew of him by reputation as a gifted editor, and I knew that he'd liked Joe. We collaborated on Towards the Mark."
"He did a good job on it, did he?"
Fancourt's flash of bad temper had gone. If anything, he looked entertained by Strike's line of questioning.
"Yes," he said, taking a sip of wine. "Very good. But you didn't want to work with him now you've moved to Roper Chard." "Not particularly," said Fancourt, still smiling. "He drinks a lot these days."
"Why do you think Quine put Waldegrave in Bombix Mori?"
"How can I possibly know that?"
"Waldegrave seems to have been good to Quine. It's hard to see why Quine felt the need to attack him."
"Is it?" asked Fancourt,
eyeing Strike closely.
"Everyone I talk to seems to have a different angle on the Cutter character in Bombix Mori." "Really?"
"Most people seem outraged that Quine attacked Waldegrave at all. They can't see what Waldegrave did to deserve it.
Daniel Chard thinks the Cutter shows that Quine had a collaborator," said Strike.
"Who the hell does he think would have collaborated with Quine on Bombix Mori?" asked Fancourt, with a short laugh.
"He's got ideas," said Strike.
"Meanwhile, Waldegrave thinks the Cutter's really an attack on you."
But I'm vainglorious, said Fancourt with a smile. Everyone knows that.
Why would Waldegrave think that the cutter is about you?
You'll need to ask Jerry Waldegrave, said Fancourt, still smiling. But I've got a funny feeling you think you know, Mr. Strike. And I'll tell you this. Quine was quite wrong, as he really should have known. On pass.
So in all these years, you've never managed to sell Tullgarth Road.
It's been very difficult to find a buyer who satisfies the terms of Joe's will. It was a quixotic gesture of Joe's. He was a romantic, an idealist. I set down my feelings about all of this, the legacy, the burden, the poignancy of his bequest, in House of Hollow, said Fancourt, much like a lecturer recommending additional reading. Owen had his say, such as it was, added Fancourt, with the ghost of a smirk, in The Balzac Brothers.
The Balzac Brothers was about the house in Tullgarth Road, was it? Asked Strike, who had not gleaned that impression during the 50 pages he had read.
It was set there. Really, it's about our relationship. The three of us, said Fancourt. Joe dead in the corner, and Owen and I trying to follow in his footsteps, making sense of his death. It was set in the studio where, I think, from what I've read, you found Quine's body.
Strike said nothing, but continued to take notes.
The critic Harvey Bird called the Balzac brothers wincingly, jaw-droppingly, sphincter-clenchingly awful.
I just remember a lot of fiddling with balls, said Strike. And Fancourt gave a sudden, unforced, girlish titter.
You've read it, have you? Oh yes, Owen was obsessed with his balls.
The actor beside them had paused for breath at last. Fancourt's words rang in a temporary silence. Strike grinned as the actor and his two dining companions stared at Fancourt, who treated them to his sour smile. The three men began talking hurriedly again.
He had a real E-Day fix, said Fancourt, turning back to Strike. Picasso-esque, you know. His testicles the source of his creative power. He was obsessed in both his life and his work with machismo, virility, fertility. Some might say it was an odd fixation for a man who liked to be tied up and dominated, but I see it as a natural consequence, the yin and yang of Quine's sexual persona. You'll have noticed the names he gave us in the book.
Vas and Varicocele, said Strike, and he noted again that slight surprise in Fancourt that a man who looked like Strike read books, or paid attention to their contents.
Vas. Quine. The duct that carries sperm from balls to penis. The healthy, potent, creative force. Varicocele. A painful enlargement of a vein in the testicle, sometimes leading to infertility. A typically crass Quine-esque allusion to the fact that I contracted mumps shortly after Joe died, and in fact was too unwell to go to the funeral, but also to the fact that, as you've pointed out, I was writing under difficult circumstances around that time.
You were still friends at this point, Strike clarified.
When he started the book, we were still, in theory, friends, said Fancourt with a grim smile. But writers are a savage breed, Mr. Strike. If you want lifelong friendship and selfless camaraderie, join the army and learn to kill. If you want a lifetime of temporary alliances with peers who will glory in your every failure, write novels.
Strike smiled. Fancourt said with detached pleasure,
"The Balzac brothers receive some of the worst reviews I've ever read."
"Did you review it?"
"No," said Fancourt.
"You were married to your first wife at this point?" Strike asked.
"That's right,"
said Fancourt. The flicker of his expression was like the shiver of an animal's flank when a fly touches it. I'm just trying